Hi, and welcome to episode 3, season 2 of The Matchup, a storytelling podcast from St. Paul's Episcopal Church in glorious and rainy Winston-Salem, North Carolina, where you, the listener, gets to decide who told the most compelling story. As always, I am your host, Jason Franklin, and today I have with me the Reverend Lucy Strandlin. Hi, Lucy.
Hi, Jason.
Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Good to have you back.
So good to be back.
And for her season 2 debut, award-winning contributor, the Reverend Nancy Maders.
Wow, no pressure.
Hi,
thank
Nancy.
You.
What's
thank
up?
Thank you, Jason. I'm just happy to be here. I'm rusty, but here I am. Case it's dark. Just ate lunch. Everything's great.
We just ate lunch, so we're very tired, but that's okay. We're going to push through. And in case you listener didn't know this, last season we won an award for best podcast, and it was the episode that Nancy Maders and Mark Roger Graves did
for the creepiest
New Testament story. It was Eutychus, and it was the beheading of John the Baptist.
Oh, yeah. I do remember
with
that
with lots
one.
Of other fascinating references.
Both great stories. How are you feeling today, Nancy? You ready?
Rusty.
You a little rusty?
Tired. I haven't done... It's been a long time.
Yeah, it's been a while. We took a pause.
I'm either under or over prepared, so I'll let the listener decide.
So, Lucy, this is your second one for season 2. You got any advice for Nancy over there?
Heck no. She's on her own.
Yeah, she's not going to help
me. Award-winning podcaster. She's fine.
Not today. It'll be a Razzie after this.
Hey, an award's an award. Today, we are continuing our Ministers of the Church series. Last episode, we talked about lay ministers with Dixon, who told us about Ralph Adams Cram, who happens to be the architect of the building we are currently in. And Mark talked about Eleanor Roosevelt.
Ooh, yeah. Interesting choices.
Today, we are talking about the most interesting deacon in church history. My first question for both of you is, why didn't either of you pick Nancy?
Womp womp. Why didn't you, Lucy?
I wanted to.
Think fast, Nancy.
And I wasn't sure it was fair to our other deacon on staff.
That's true.
Or, you know, lots of deacons who are around here.
And I also think I would be a better contender for worst deacon in church history. So maybe if you decide to do that one, call me up.
All right, then, Nancy, then tell us what makes a deacon a deacon.
I'm so glad you asked, Jason, and shocking and surprised that you would ask me that question. So a deacon is it's an order of ordained ministry that is focused on service. And I always like to say it's kind of like it's a ministry that has one foot in the church and one foot in the world. And in the actual in the ordination to the diaconate, which is in the Book of Common Prayer, it says you are to interpret the needs, concerns, and hopes of the world to the church. Mm. And there's two types. There are transitional deacons, and those folks typically go on to be ordained to the priesthood after, 6 months? A year?
Yeah, it depends on your diocese, but usually 6 months.
Mm. And then there's what I am, which is a vocational deacon, and that is I'm a permanent deacon. So my call was really about service. It was 12 years ago. So what was my call? Was it from God? I don't know. So I was a clinical chaplain. I worked in hospitals and I worked for hospice, and I had no intention of getting ordained actually at all. But I felt like, I was missing a critical component of my ministry. I was not anchored to the church in a way that I felt I should be. And when I read the ordination to the diaconate, I thought, that's it. That's it. That is what I want to do. You know, I want to work in the world and I want to serve folks who at the time, you know, were sick and their families and in that context. And I also wanted to be a part of the world of the church. That's what was missing for me. Mm. So that a deacon kind of moves in and out of those worlds, the church and the world.
All right. And Lucy.
And priests are fine.
Priests are fine, right, Lucy?
Sometimes.
Were you a transitional deacon?
Yeah. So every priest has to be ordained a deacon in the Episcopal Church, ordained a deacon first. You're a deacon. You're supposed to really learn that role before you're ordained a priest. And they say once a deacon, always a deacon. Mm-hmm. So it's not like I renounced my orders as a deacon. Sure, I'm also called to do ministry in the world, but I've got, and then kind of this added layer. I don't know. It's hard to talk about, but it sort of slightly direction different direction of call towards priesthood.
Most deacons have their work and service and call that they do in the world apart from the church. And then the bishop, they're actually under the designation of the bishop. The bishop appoints deacons to whatever church they serve. Mm. So I am appointed here at St. Paul's, and before I was appointed at St. Anne's. And they're actually liturgical roles that only the deacon does during the service. So reading, proclaiming the gospel in the middle of the congregation, that's a diaconal role. Setting the table before the Eucharist, that's another diaconal role, and so is the dismissal. And the dismissal can be done different ways. We used to do it kind of in the middle of the church where the gospel is, where you kind of send people out. And now we do it from the altar after the blessing. But it's kind of that sending folks back out into the world, that's kind of the deacon's job to do. So that's why they do things like the dismissal and proclaim the gospel.
Cool.
Yeah, and it's like, has a history of serving at table and proclaiming the word, and then you do both of those things within the context of the service, which is really cool. I mean, that's supposed to be out in the world as well, but deacon sets the table, proclaims the gospel, sends us out to the world, and also, I interpret the vows and the description of the prayer book as kind of keeping us all accountable to making sure we're not just being insular within the church, but also making sure we're turning outward in our ministry and work into the world.
And most deacons preach. I preach, of course, and this isn't a hard and fast rule, but I try to usually preach from the gospel text. I feel like that's part of my job to do, but not always. Not always. Depends on how good the Old Testament is. Yeah. That's a better story.
Sometimes you can't ignore it. Yeah.
That's right. Sometimes you just can't help yourself. But that.
And you vest differently. If you come to church, you can identify who the deacon is.
That's right. I get to wear all those cool dalmatics that we have.
Mm-hmm. Why don't you tell the listeners what a dalmatic is?
A dalmatic is a fancy bib. it is, what would you call it? It's a robe? It's anyway.
It usually matches the frontal, which is on the altar, color. And the chasuble, which is worn by the celebrant, the priest who's leading worship. Right.
And so it has two bars across of it to designate that it's the dalmatic. It's for the deacon to wear. Don't ask me about those bars. I don't know what that means. And typically it's different from the tunicle. I know we're getting in the weeds because the crucifer, who is not ordained, who is an acolyte, typically wears the tunicle, has one bar. Wow. And then I wear the dalmatic, which has two, which designates that I'm the deacon. And the priest who's celebrating wears the chasuble. So we all have our fancy bibs that mean different things. And they'll correspond to whatever the color of the season is. And right now I'm not wearing one because it's Lent and we don't have a dalmatic for Lent, which is appropriate. Should be a simpler time.
More sparse time, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but your stole is over your left shoulder rather than two pieces hanging down like a priest stole. It looks different. The deacon stole.
There you go, listeners.
See,
the questions
you
needed answers
to.
People are
often curious because they're like, I see all this, but I don't exactly know what it means. And Deacon Lauren has been great with our children to like sort of say like, okay, you can identify who's who in the service and what their role is based on what they're wearing.
Right.
And our movements are all different. And it is really cool. The more you learn about the different vestments and the different orders of ministry. And it's another reason why I often sit in the bishop's chair, the cathedra, is because I belong to the bishop. I'm appointed by the bishop. You know, I don't belong to St. Paul's. The bishop can decide at any time where to put me. And so I have to listen to him or her. But when the bishop is not present, I sit at the cathedra. And when the bishop is present, I got to be right there. I have to do all the bishop's chaplain-y things, you know, hold the hat, move the crozier, make sure they have their bulletin, whatever the bishop needs. That's why I'm here.
All right, cool. Well, let's get into
Jason's
it.
Jason's like more than anyone wanted to know.
Where is our little star moving across the screen?
I think it is. I think it genuinely is interesting, especially for people who are newer to the church. To kind of know that these things are really thought out and intentional.
You know, we just put on whatever when we get there Sunday.
Go where the Spirit moves us.
Whatever we feel like.
All right. Well, it's time for our two guests to present their case. We'll talk a little about it. And after the episode, you listeners will vote on who told the most compelling story. Lucy, would you like to kick us off?
You know, bold move letting the not letting the deacon go first. I see.
Actually, no. That's right. You went first last time, didn't you? Now that I think
I
about
did,
it.
I did, but I wasn't going to say anything. Because last time I complained and you called me up.
I think, Nancy, I think you should go first.
Whoa. I like this.
Yeah, let's let the deacons first.
But only because it worked out in my favor.
Why?
Do you like going first?
No, I like going second.
Oh, well, there you are.
Oh, yeah. Well, look, it worked out for both of us.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. I wonder how many people like going first versus second.
It's scary to go first.
Is it?
But then I like to hear what the other person's got before I go.
Well, we know it's not the same because we have to tell Jason.
I'm glad I could accommodate both of you. Nancy, would you like to go first?
Okay. So I feel like my pick is going to surprise folks because a lot of folks may not know that this person was a deacon, but it is the one and only St. Francis of Assisi, who was a deacon and the founder of the Franciscan order.
Interesting.
And he was never ordained a priest. And there's historical data that indicates he was ordained a deacon in order to preach and proclaim the gospel. But the fight over it is, was he ordained earlier in his life or later in his life? And was it really something he didn't want to do because of his vows of humility? So he definitely was never ordained to the priesthood. And the historical kind of battle is, when was he ordained to the diaconate? So it's really hard to talk about St. Francis. There is so much out there about this guy.
Yeah.
And so I was like, you can't tell his whole life story. It's too much. Like, you know, everybody has this kind of vision of him. Like, is he Cinderella with birds on his shoulder?
Right.
He's
blessing
so
of the
sweet
animals.
And kind and blessing of the animals. Sweet and kind are not the words I would use to describe Francis. Intense.
Kind of intense.
Kind of intense. So because there's so much and it was hard to narrow, I want to focus like less on the legend stuff. Like, you know, did he go out to the forest and like tame a wolf, or, you know, did the birds land on him during one of his sermons? I don't.
They did in every church garden.
In your mind, they might. And in your statue, in your own personal garden, they might do that. But I'm going to focus less on that and more on his actual life and kind of his early life and ministry. And if you, readers, if you're looking to read more about this book, Francis of Assisi, A New Biography by Augustine Thompson, is amazing.
Cool.
She's holding it up for
I'm
us
holding
to look
it
at.
Up yeah, because can everyone see? Can see this.
This is an audio medium.
It's a really very readable biography, very well researched, and just, it's good stuff. So read away, listeners. So I want to talk about his early life. He was born in Assisi, which is a little Italian city kind of in the Umbrian region, about 3,000 people, which is sizable, when he was born in 1181.
Okay.
And he was bougie. He came from a wealthy family. And this is my favorite part I was reading in this book, that there are actually tax records from that time that indicate his family's home was in the top third most affluent homes in Assisi. And I was like, way to humble brag.
Right.
So there actually exist tax receipts of Francis's bouginess. Just so you know.
They were in Assisi Monthly magazine.
They were,
sure.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. They were in the right zip code in Assisi, evidently. So, but they weren't noble. They weren't a noble family. So Francis's father, Pietro, was a very successful global merchant. I think he was a textile merchant.
Yeah.
And so Francis was born in 1181. You'll love this, Lucy, as did I. He was baptized as an infant during the Easter Vigil.
Oh, of course he was.
Yay. I know. As
cool service.
Proper and amazing.
Just as an aside, we have three baptisms coming up at our Easter Vigil.
So you
so please join
come.
Us.
Yeah.
Early Easter this year.
March 30th at 7:30 p.m.
I like that. I like how you did that. So this is kind of like, this is the world that Francis is growing up in. He, by 14, he's fluent in Italian and French, and he's traveling with his father, and, you know, he's poised to take over the family business. And everyone loved Francis. Like, he had this kind of personality that drew people in, and, you know, gregarious and outgoing. And he actually, when he was a teenager, he ran around with this, like, group of guys in Assisi and partied. And he was just kind of a showboat, right? He was a bougie Showboat. Envision that in any way you would like, listeners, whatever that version of Francis is for you, that's what he was. But he had this life-changing experience as a young man. He was conscripted to serve in this local militia because there was like some turmoil in the local governments. And he went to battle and watched a bunch of his friends just get butchered in front of him. And he was actually held as a prisoner of war for a year.
Wow.
So this totally changed his whole perspective and changed how it wasn't a spiritual transformation. I think what we call it now is PTSD. Mm. So when he came home, he was a completely changed person. He was haunted by dreams. He had flashbacks. He had all these feelings of guilt and self-loathing. And so already is gone the kind of carefree son of a rich merchant whose future seemed set in stone. And so he left his home. He started kind of wandering and from village to village, wandering in the forest outside of Assisi. Eventually, he sold his weapons, sold his horse, and he was trying to just kind of rid himself of this experience that he had. And he began to go and pray at this church called San Damiano, and he asked God this: "Most high and glorious God, enlighten the darkness of my heart and give me a true faith, certain hope, and perfect charity. Give me perception and knowledge, Lord, that I might carry out your holy and true command." So he ends up living at this church for a little while. And when he finally does return to Assisi, you know, he made it clear he was kind of ready to leave that old life behind and abandon his future as a family merchant. He just didn't want anything else to do with that. And his father was enraged by this. And his father was also concerned because there was this rule that if something happened, he, Francis, would inherit his mother's dowry, which was evidently significant. And his father was worried about that. And so his father actually locked him in their home, in the family home, imprisoned him in the home. But while he was away, love to all you moms out there, Francis's mother let him go.
Is he like a young adult at this age?
Yeah. Okay. He's fought in the war, so he's probably like late teens, somewhere around there. And so Pietro, his father, took him to court. And Francis is not a dummy. And Francis said, he made sure to say in the court that he was now an ecclesiastical person. And so he did not recognize the authority of the court, only the church. And so the trial actually ends up taking place in front of a bishop. And that this is the famous scene that people remember about Francis, where he like strips his clothes off and says, you know, I'm no longer a part of the world. And he lays them at his father's feet. And that is true. He does do this. And evidently, according to history and legend, the bishop takes his cloak off and covers Francis with it. And this is, to me, this is the very telling part. And there's no evidence that he and his father had any interaction beyond this, like after this scene in the courtroom. Francis says this: "Until now, I have called Pietro del Bernardone my father, but because I have proposed to serve God, I return him the money on account of which he is so upset, and I also return all the clothing which is his. From now on, I say, our Father who art in heaven, not my father Pietro."
Ooh.
Ouch.
Yeah.
Whew. So, again, that was it. I mean, that was really severing the ties with his family and with that life that was perfectly laid out for him.
Wow.
I do wonder, though, if he ever had contact with his mother after that.
Yeah.
Don't know. So now Francis is really independent and doesn't really have any clear direction, though, about what this really means for him. So, again, he often is found around the forest in Assisi and wandering. He didn't really have a spiritual call or awakening until he had this interaction and engagement with this leper colony, which is outside of Assisi. And the interesting thing about Francis is when he was this kind of gregarious young man floating about the town in his fancy clothes and convertibles. Okay, obviously not, but I envision him in a convertible, whatever. He was absolutely horrified by lepers, like their appearance. He wanted nothing to do with them, but he ends up caring for lepers in this leper colony, working alongside of them. And this is kind of when he starts to find this spiritual peace and renewal, when he's serving others. And this became his gospel call: to give to the poor, take nothing on the journey and embrace the cross. He also took that as a call to, he started repairing the church where he was living. And he started kind of making a name for himself. Folks started following him. And he started to become known for this, way of life, for, you know, his service and, service to the poor specifically. So he and his followers go to Rome. They get approval from the bishop, and they set out to live and preach this life of penitence and service to the poor and gospel proclamation. And another cool thing about Francis is that he helped found, support, and start the female order of the Poor Clares. Claire was a woman similar to Francis from a wealthy family who decided that she wanted to follow this way of life, this Franciscan way of life. And he made sure that she was vested and supported, and he helped house her and other women at the Cathedral Chapters Church in San Damiano. And that was the first convent for the female Franciscan movement, and it exists to this day, the Poor Clares. And that was founded in 1212.
Wow.
And I mentioned his kind of love of nature. You can't talk about Francis and not talk about this. I mean, he's the patron saint of animals, and we have the blessing of the animals near his feast day. But I said, it's not like Cinderella, okay? Right. That's not the kind of dude he was. He really retreated to nature when he was having, in times of spiritual unrest. He just could not live amongst either his followers at the time. I mean, oftentimes this book mentions when things start to get too organized within his order or around him, he bolts.
That's interesting.
And so it's true. Like, you know, he did have a love. He was not a vegetarian, okay? He's not a vegetarian. If meat was prepared for him, he would eat it.
Okay.
But if living meat was brought to him to be prepared, he'd let it go. So that was his,
seems like a very interesting distinction.
If you bring me a hamburger, I will eat it. But if you bring me the cow, I don't think I'm going to be able to do that. So there's this kind of famous story that someone brought them, or the brothers, you know, a rabbit. And he was like, release this rabbit or whatever. And the rabbit wouldn't go. The rabbit like kept hopping along. And they were like, he finally was like, you got to take the rabbit into the forest. Like, you got to get this rabbit.
Someone get rid of this
rabbit. Get this rabbit out of here.
For its own good.
And there's this famous sermon to the birds where, you know, he ends up kind of preaching to the birds and talking about, you know, their place in the created kingdom of God. Right. And I think that's why. So our little Francis panel in our stained glass is in the stairwell next to the nave, like where the choir gathers. Yeah. Lucy, is there a word for that?
I mean,
because to me, it's stairwell.
Right, if you go out by the font and the St. Paul statue, yes. Like if you're in the church and you exit to the left by the St. Paul statue and then look to your left, there's a stained glass window.
Yeah. So it's Francis and in his traditional, you know, garb. And there are birds everywhere. And in fact, last Sunday I remarked, why is it just birds? Why are there so?
I was like, no wonder you were so like upset about that window.
Many
like,
birds.
He didn't even like birds.
Where's the rabbit?
I know. There should be a rabbit. There just won't leave.
Maybe there
side.
Is. Maybe I need to go back. Maybe there's a rabbit in the background. But I think it's a reference to this sermon to the birds. And that's why he is making like a blessing sign with his hands. But to me, it looks like he's swatting them like too many birds. It's right next. Is it next to St. Christopher?
St. Christopher, yeah.
Yeah, so the two panels are side by side. But you should, you know, hang out in the stairwell with us and check it out. So the ordination of the diaconate, the exact date isn't known. And some historians say it was done later in his life because he had no desire to be ordained to the priesthood because even though the altar and the Eucharist were critically important to him, it's not the focus of his call. And then others say he was ordained earlier than that because he wrote this impassioned letter to the clergy and he includes himself as a member of the clergy in this letter. And I thought you would love this, Lucy, because Lucy and I do a lot of setting up and the altar and making sure everything's where it should be. He had so much admiration for the Eucharist that he was angered when he saw, quote, cheap and tarnished chalices and filthy linens.
Oh,
I was like, same, Francis.
Yeah.
Filthy linens.
And so he nobody wants to see that. So he was very, I wouldn't say he was obsessed with the Eucharist, but it was very important to him. But it was not. He always wanted to be around the altar, but not celebrating the Eucharist. And
maybe say what celebrating is for
the person who breaks the host and who says the words at the altar around the bread and the wine. So that was, but Francis took a lot of care and respect for how that was done. He just did not want to be the person doing it.
Why do you think that is?
I think it's because of his call to service and to the world. And I don't think he ever saw himself that he could completely be of service at the altar in particular and with the Eucharist when his call was so clearly to serving the poor.
Mm.
So the most famous story of Francis vested as a deacon wearing the dalmatic, I would say, was at this Christmas mass in the town of Greccio, where he's depicted wearing the dalmatic. He sang the gospel and he actually instituted the first live nativity scene.
So those animals who were following him around.
That bunny.
Put them to work.
That donkey. I don't know. I mean, no donkey burgers. But anyway, so there it was an infant. So it's a scene of him kind of placing the infant in the crib of the nativity. And that was never done before, before Francis. He instituted this. And so there's two famous frescoes that show Francis in the dalmatic. And often he's placing the child in the crib. And there's a really famous painting by Giotto, the Italian artist, that shows Francis in the dalmatic placing the infant in the manger. And so this is kind of how folks realize, yes, he was ordained to the diaconate, but this scene at Greccio was later in his life. He died shortly after.
Hmm.
So he was ordained when, folks don't know, but I do think that he emphasizes the life of a deacon in his call to service. Mm. And his life was absolutely fascinating. And I think he just is emblematic of what a very intense deacon can be when given the opportunity. So Francis is he's complicated and he struggled. But I think in his service to God and the poor and creation, that's why he's got to be the most famous deacon in church history. That's awesome. Not the prompt.
That's not.
What'd you say?
Most interesting? Interesting. Yeah.
Well, same. Famous and interesting.
Thank you, Nancy.
You're welcome.
Lucy, did you think about St. Francis? Do you know St. Francis well?
Yep. Super well. It's like, are we
friends?
You
guys are buds?
Yeah.
They hang out.
I don't think I knew that he wasn't. I don't think I knew what his ordination was.
Me neither.
It doesn't surprise me because, I mean, I do remember learning that, like, he was very, I think this is Francis, like, when every time, so, you know, he would gain these huge followings and they would want to sort of settle down in one place and acquire the things, like, have a Bible and have, I think this is Francis, I don't think I'm confusing him with somebody else, have a Bible, have some things to build a life. And he was like, no, like he did not want to start a community in one place. He wanted to be on the move out in the world. So it is a very good like deacon thing. And so the not wanting to become a priest and celebrate the Eucharist makes sense because you have to be sort of somewhat stationary and within the institution of the church to be in that role. And I could see why he would resist it. But anytime your group gets larger, there's this urge to sort of institutionalize. Right. And he was like, no, I don't.
And I guess he kind of lost the battle because it didn't become like a very important part of Christian practice.
Yeah.
Franciscans.
Yeah. But he was very radical, which is, you know, it's a funny part of kind of I love the blessing of the animals.
Right.
And we kind of run the risk of sanitizing him.
Right.
And sort of missing like how radical he was about serving the poor and all that.
I think because of the animal thing, people think, oh, he was a quiet,
kind,
meek and mild.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
He
was kind of the opposite.
Yeah.
Of that.
Yeah.
So
that's good.
Lucy, you're going to tell the deacon in the room why her choice for most interesting deacon was the wrong choice.
This is Jason.
It's getting harsh
Thanks
in here.
A lot.
I'm just kidding.
Jason, I'll pay you that $50. I got that $50 for you later.
I'm very excited to hear who you picked.
Because you have no idea.
I have no idea either. I'm ready.
I'm really glad you sort of bent the rules, because I also sort of bent the rules.
Yeah, originally I even forgot this. We were specifically going to talk about Episcopal deacons.
Well, you didn't say that, brother.
It was somewhere, and I also ignored it, and then like knew exactly who I wanted to talk about, and then went back and was like, "Oh, Episcopal." So yes. Jason agreed that we could change it.
Yeah, we need to pop that bubble.
Yeah.
So, these are great deacons. Okay, so mine is, what is it, most interesting?
Yeah.
Most interesting deacon in church history is the very first deacon.
Ooh. Sweet Stephen.
Oh. That's not who it is.
What? the first biblical deacon?
Well, just wait.
Okay, I'm ready.
Just wait. Let me make my case to you, and then you can decide one of our favorite deacons if you think. You know, if you're convinced. Okay, so I'm going to talk about the Gospel of Mark, because it's my favorite. And we believe it's the earliest gospel of the four.
Yep.
And it's the one that we are in this current lectionary year, which is basically like the cycle of readings we read on Sunday. So Mark is the gospel for this coming year. And so in the very first chapter of Mark, Jesus is just beginning his ministry. He has been... I think this is right after his baptism. This is Mark chapter 1, verse 29. As soon as they left the synagogue, they entered the house of Simon and Andrew with James and John. Now Simon's mother-in-law was in bed with a fever, and they told him about her at once. He came and took her by the hand and lifted her up. Then the fever left her, and she began to serve them. And then that evening at sunset, they brought to him all who were sick or possessed with demons, and the whole city was gathered around the door. And he cured many who were sick with various diseases and cast out many demons. And he would not permit the demons to speak because they knew him. So hidden in there is our very first deacon. And from the earliest gospel, the first chapter of Mark. Simon's mother-in-law, it's sort of disguised because of our translation. But the phrase, she began to serve them, the verb there, serve them, is from the word diakono. Which is to serve, but also to minister. And now you may be thinking, okay, so Jesus healed her just so she could get up and wait on them and cook for them and give them food.
Give me some bread.
Great. That sounds really fun. But you would be missing a lot if we stopped there. So that word is sort of packed with meaning. First of all, it is more like an active... It's like to actively serve, literally kicking up dust because you're on the move, which is cool because that is very much like Francis as well. And there are a few other places where this word is used in, I'm just sticking within the Gospel of Mark, but guess who is the very first to do this verb in the Gospel? I won't make you guess, but in the Gospel of Mark, the angels in the wilderness when Jesus is baptized
on him.
In the first chapter,
that's right,
and the Spirit drives him out to the wilderness. He was in the wilderness for 40 days, tempted by Satan, and he was with the wild beasts, and the angels waited on him.
That's right.
The same word. They like provide for his needs. In Mark, it doesn't seem like he's fasting. It's like the angels are providing for him. So just kind of keep in mind that providing for and ministering. So then the very next, you know, just like 15 verses, if I'm doing my math right, 17 verses later, Peter's mother-in-law or Simon's mother-in-law is described in the same way, that same verb. She began to serve them. And you'll notice it like leads directly, like right after that, she begins to serve them. Then he immediately is able to like heal all these people. Like she is a necessary part of this ministry. You got to eat. And like she's basically empowering them to do this ministry that is Jesus to do and the disciples to do in this situation. But her ministry is a very integral part to that. The next place it shows up is when in Mark 10, when James and John want to be the best ones. And when the 10 hear this, they are angry with them. And so Jesus kind of gives the like, whoever wishes to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wishes to be first among you must be slave of all. For the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many. So again, that word to serve is
diakonos. It's a real Jesus mic drop moment.
So we got angels, we got the Son of Man. Like, this is not a meek and mild, like you said. This is not a meek and mild verb. And then the next time is in Mark 15 at the crucifixion. It says, Jesus gave a loud cry and breathed his last. And the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. Now, when the centurion who stood facing him saw that in this way, he breathed his last. He said, truly, this man was God's son. There were also women looking on from a distance. Among them were Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James the Younger, and of Joseph and Salome. These used to follow him and provided for him when he was in Galilee. And there were many other women who had come up with him to Jerusalem. There's a group of women who travel with Jesus and the disciples and are among his followers who provide for them. But again, this is more like a person providing for them out of their means. Mm-hmm. In Luke, the same kind of scene, it says there, he's in Luke 8, he's talking about him traveling around spreading the good news of the kingdom of God. The 12 were with him, as well as some women, Mary called Magdalene, from whom seven demons had gone out, and Joanna, the wife of Herod's steward Chuza, and Susanna, and many others who provided for them out of their resources. So these were likely women of means who were providing for Jesus and basically like making their ministry possible to, you know, have food and other resources. So it's not a, it is service and it's empowerment in a way, like, to make something possible, to provide for, to minister to. And then if you kind of, moving from the Gospels to Romans, chapter 16, if you get to the very end of Romans, the first verse of chapter 16, Paul talks about Phoebe, who is,
love Phoebe.
First verse of chapter 16, I commend to you our sister Phoebe, a deacon of the church, so that you may welcome her in the Lord as is fitting for the saints, and help her in whatever she may require from you, for she has been a benefactor of many and of myself as well. So there's some case to be made that she might be the one who is delivering this letter and proclaiming it. Like the way that Paul's letters would have likely worked is that someone would have delivered it and given it out loud.
Yeah.
That it's not, not everybody could read. It's a verbal letter. So that she would have been the one sent out to proclaim the word. But also that she was we can tell from the context, she is a leader in the church. And a benefactor, it's a different verb. It's not the deacon word, but she is described directly as a deacon by Paul. Whereas Peter's mother-in-law isn't, but I think there's like a case to be made for this certain sort of role that we see throughout the New Testament of someone who is providing for people, serving, a part of the ministry. And I highlight it one because like we don't always hear, when people are recounting Gospels or New Testament, we don't always hear the stories of women because for so often those have been sort of repressed or ignored or just we're not looking for them. But these are some pretty powerful women who are present, traveling with Jesus, providing for him out of their resources. And then you have someone like Phoebe, who is literally named a deacon by Paul and is clearly a leader in the church, possibly preaching, definitely like a benefactor of the church, making it possible. Just to kind of add another layer to this, we know that in Acts, when we have the first, deacons, it comes out of a sort of a conflict that's happening in the early church because, there was a complaint that widows were being neglected in the daily distribution of food. And so the 12 come together to figure out, to sort of designate people who are in charge of serving at table while others are out sharing the word. So they kind of had to they got into the place where they needed to sort of divvy up the roles. And so the first deacons were to be those who participate in this daily distribution of food to make sure people are fed. And so those are like Stephen and other deacons named that day. And this, again, sometimes there seems to be sort of a priority on a status thing on preachers of the word versus those who are serving at table. Yeah. It's not as powerful of a thing, But I went to a conference several years ago where Andrew McGowan spoke, and he's the dean of the Divinity School at Yale, Berkeley Divinity School at Yale, the Episcopal Divinity School there. And he, part of his scholarship is on early Christianity, and he's done a lot of work around like the Eucharist and bread. And his talk really changed things for me. And there's a sort of a summary of it on his blog, but his name's Andrew McGowan. So you should go to the source if you're interested in this. This is my, yeah. you know, secondhand retelling of it. But he talked about how many people, like first Christians, lived in a state of food insecurity. So more than half of incomes went to food. And for city dwellers, if you think about it, you're not growing, like you have to yeah. grow a lot of grain to get enough to make bread. For city dwellers, it was common to seek invitations to dine from wealthier patrons, or to rely on free or subsidized bread or grain when it was available. So many people like had to work to find bread on a daily basis. Like finding food was a big drain on your resources of time and of income. And so like people who were wealthy and could be patrons would dole out bread or parcels of food. But as you can imagine, that could be a means of sort of control. Like it's a means of having people depend on you yeah. And they could sort of ask things of like, well, if I'm your patron and this is first century Roman Empire, like I worship this god or these gods, like I expect you to also do what I do. Yeah. And so it was sort of this power move. It could be a power move. And it's also like, if you're a person who has another job within the city and you can't grow grain, can't make bread, and you're reliant on somebody to provide that, you're depending on someone to provide that for you, like what an insecure position that is to constantly be worried. I mean, we know like, you know, what food insecurity we see, like how much that can impact your daily life and yeah. prevent you from like thriving as a human. So it was this real like power imbalance if you're depending on others to provide food for you. So for the early church to provide bread for people mm. like in the Eucharist and these deacons to be providing food, that's like, it's enough. If you're a part of this community, like we care for each other and we distribute bread, distribute food. Think how empowering that is. Like if you know it's not dependent on this power imbalance, so this patron, yeah. but that actually God is your patron or Christ is your patron, and the bread distribution happens just as a matter of course as being a part of the church. Yeah. How liberating that is and how empowering that is so that you can go live your life and serve and be a part of like the ministry of the church and sharing the good news and all of that. So it's not like a, you know, preaching the word is better and serving a table is like, you know, lesser. It's like they all work together to make like one makes the other possible.
And I think like in the appointment of Stephen and that whole kind of like, we need to be out here preaching the word, but also we have to be of service. We cannot leave this portion of our call behind.
Right.
And I think part of the call to the diaconate is that you are in service in a way that you are always aware of and in conversation with the most vulnerable around you. I think that is a very important part of the call to the diaconate. Mm. And I think you're right, Lucy. That's how they were to differentiate those roles from the very beginning.
Yeah, to make sure it didn't get forgotten. Because I was like, this is critical. This is a part of who we are. Like Jesus fed people.
It's what Jesus did. That's right.
Yeah, and like it's also necessary in order to survive and live. You know, people needed to be fed. And so, yeah, she is like Peter's mother-in-law is kind of like that first model of like that important role of a deacon, which is to feed people. And sometimes we see that as like a not super, you know, we sort of downplay the role of domestic, like someone who cooks for people or, you know, yeah. and someone who works within the home or all that. How do you live without that?
Right.
So, I mean, for one thing, I wouldn't want to downplay that role, even if it didn't have anything to do with the ministry of Jesus. And she's really like a prototype of all the deacons because she's feeding them so that they can, she's doing this role. Others are doing other roles. Right. All the roles are necessary and critical. And then just kind of that added layer of like how how powerful it was to provide food in a system where so many were food insecure and were looking every day for, like, where's my next meal going to come from? Where's my next meal going to come from? So quite literally, like, deacons are, what is it, kicking up dust on the move, because they're sort of shaking things up and empowering others to serve and to be the church.
And not a lot of folks want to be reminded about the vulnerable among us. And I think that's the harder part, too, of a deacon's job is to, you have, it literally says in your ordination, you are to bring the hopes, needs, and concerns of the world to the church. That's not always the easiest thing to do or the most well-received thing.
What's that line in the prayer from St. Francis? Like, come to the church not only for...
Did you say prayer of Saint Francis?
Yeah, but I did not.
In prayer D it says, prevent us from coming to this table for solace only and not for strength, for pardon only and not for renewal.
Sorry, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah. But the prayer of Saint Francis is like, help me not so much seek to be served as to serve
others. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And cool. Same idea. Yeah. You said first D, and I was like, Stephen, because he's the first biblically appointed deacon in Acts, and sadly, the first Christian martyr. So
I know. Well, what does that say for deacon?
Is he like, well, he's the first. That, and I mean, that's like traditionally the understanding. Traditional. And part of what I want to highlight is like, that's the story of church history to look to the males who are in these roles. But if it is, you know, with what Peter's mother-in-law is doing and then what these other women were doing within the Gospel of Mark. And then, you know, you've got Phoebe, who is referred to literally as a deacon, you know, with Peter's mother-in-law. I will admit it's just the use of the verb. But I want to, like, elevate that to the same level because it's the same role. And, I don't need to go on my soapbox.
Well, it's always an interesting question of what... what gets lost in translation, right?
Yeah.
And what the intention was, because a lot of stuff gets lost in translation. Cool.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Lucy.
We both have
deacons in the wild.
Yeah.
I'm also hearing from Lucy that perhaps I should provide more snacks in the break room.
Yeah, I think it should really be your responsibility.
That we can all do our work.
Exactly.
Nancy.
All right.
All
well,
of this is coming you know what? Around to say.
Forget this outreach
how
ministry.
How good it is to be the one who provides snacks.
I believe I will be now providing snacks in the break room. I'm happy to do so, actually.
Well, it does, like I said, food makes a big difference.
I mean, that is
nerd clusters for everyone. Real sustenance in the break room.
Well, feel free to stop by for some snacks provided by Nancy at St. Paul's Episcopal Church.
Don't do that. You're going to be sorely disappointed.
Well, thank you, y'all. Appreciate
Thanks.
It.
Yeah, it's fun.
Friends, the cases have been presented for the Saint or for
get it right,
the
Jason.
Most interesting deacon.
In church history.
In church history. There we go. And now the power is in your hands. Who do you think it is, listeners? Let us know. If you're listening on Spotify, there is a link to a poll in the episode description. We have a lot more great episodes coming for season 2. Check back every Thursday on Spotify and wherever you listen to podcasts. Please do all the things. Rate, like, subscribe if you enjoy the show. You can learn more about St. Paul's by visiting stpaulsws.org. You can contact me if you have show ideas, jason@stpauls-ws.org. Thanks, everyone, for listening and voting. See you later. Bye.
Bye.